All rights reserved, Steve Coleman and the Origami VanCast. Hello world, welcome to the Origami VanCast. This is your host, Steve Coleman. Today, I'm here to tell you really one of the main stories that I really hope that I get to tell everyone. But you kind of need to hear the rest of the stories first. Humans and vertebrate animals down to sea squirts, which are invertebrates, have an endocannabinoid system. So just because cannabis was used to find that this system exists is why the system is called the endocannabinoid system. Endo is short for endogenous, which means internal to your body. It was originally thought to just be like a neurochemical signaling system, but it turns out that it is a cellular level mechanism that is distributed all throughout your body in ways that aren't completely understood yet. It's still an active area of research. It was only first discovered 30 years ago. The fundamental function of this system is to maintain homeostasis, and that means maintain balance in general on a cell-by-cell basis. And it's really difficult to convey, you know, how fundamental that is. It's more fundamental than like an organ system, in my opinion. I'm no medical doctor, but there you go. So today, I guess I'm here to tell you at least what I think can happen whenever the system is messed up or has been kicked so far out of the whack by hitting enough telephone poles hard enough that it messes you up for 20 years. I would also like to just encourage everybody to be skeptical, research my words. Please don't take what I say as gospel. Do some due diligence, look into the references I provide, and look up some of the keywords that I say. You know, do your own research to the point where you're comfortable with however you're going to use the information that I put here. All right, so these are kind of some mop-up comments, but I want to make sure that I discuss the difference between industrial hemp-derived CBG or the CBG that's out there on the market on the internet and the CBG that's available in dispensaries. To be honest with you, I haven't found too big of a difference in the actual function of it. The CBG isolate that I get from industrial hemp farms seems like it's, you know, maybe a little bit weaker than the CBG that I get from the dispensary in Oklahoma. But not in a, you know, we're talking about the difference between maybe 99 and 90% effective, something like that, so... they both seem to work equally, although I do still require THC, so if I'm going to use the industrial hemp, I have to add something that I got from the dispensary anyway. The prices both at the dispensary and online are basically the same. Today I'm also going to, I guess, get a little bit more into the details about what exactly I do with CBG and what I think it's doing. And this is the part where I have to say that this show is not medical advice, and anyone listening to my words, any actions that they take, they need to take responsibility for or stop listening now. I'm not here to suggest anybody do anything other than, again, educate themselves. And then what my hope is, and I don't know how reasonable a hope this is or an expectation, but my hope is to, you know, help teach people how to experiment on themselves if they so desire. Now, I don't think that's generally considered ethical to experiment on yourself, but if you are going to kill yourself otherwise, I also don't think that is ethical. So I think experimenting on yourself is more preferable. And that's what I've done, and I do not apologize for it. What I can say is that I am not, definitely not, condoning recreational drug use. That is just not what I'm here for. That's not what I'm talking about. My dose levels and everything else may be high, but and maybe some people will say that's recreational. Certainly some states might say that's recreational. I had given up all hope of ever getting better. And for about, you know, over 15 years, I had planned on killing myself about whenever I turned 50. I assumed that I could make it that far. But as I approached the age of 40, it became pretty clear to me that I might not make it to 41. I was in very difficult to endure pain and running out of options. as I mentioned in LinkedIn, you know, I had tried marijuana before getting on fentanyl 18 months earlier. And when I failed, I took that the bags of marijuana and I put it in my gun safe on the top shelf. And I didn't use it anymore. So when I decided to get off, you know, I started using it again. And that was my supply of this very old marijuana for quite some time. I eventually ran out of that. And had gotten a new strain through through a different person. Again, you know, I was using it for pain control, but once I lost the strawberry lemonade, really, it was kind of dicey. But I ended up with this AK-47 Extreme, and it worked pretty well for me. And I would break it up and put it into a Firefly 2 dryer vaporizer set at 420 degrees Fahrenheit. I'd vape about 35 to maybe more like 60, 70 milligrams. I did weigh it, but, you know, it was typically on the order of 55 to 70 milligrams per dose, you know. And as I got later into the week, sometimes I would even use two doses. And I would use those doses at night before 8 o'clock. And pretty much as long as I got it done before 8, I'd be able to go to sleep at 10 and, you know, wake up having slept pretty doggone well, especially compared to the fentanyl years. So, you know, I was happy. So happy, in fact, you know, earlier that year I had interviewed at Apple and, they made me an offer, which I ended up not taking, but it buoyed me, you know, and it gave me a lot of confidence. And so, as I look for jobs later on that year, ended up taking a challenging one and you know, I packed my desk with a certain amount of a joy, like you always do. But I was really still in a lot of pain. And obviously, you know, you pack your things at the end. So this was Thursday. My last day was going to be Friday. I packed up my office. I had this big, heavy chair that was all articulated, that supported my spine, that, you know, I could barely stand to sit in it. I had a couple of copier paper boxes, maybe one other box full of books that I had taken down from the shelf that was about shoulder level and put onto my desk into the boxes. And I was going to carry those out, but that's the extent of the work that I did. But it took all day to get my whole office ready. And I went home, I was in quite a lot of pain. I had also received a new toy that I bought myself because I'm... was an audiophile and really enjoyed, you know, high-end music, that sort of thing. I bought myself a nice little music player, a personal music player to have in my new office and while I traveled. So I was excited about loading some music on that, and I was talking to a fellow audiophile friend of mine on the phone when I got home. And rather than do my normal dry herb vape thing, I took about, you know, just a nugget of twice as much flower as I would normally use, about roughly, put it into the pipe. Put it into a glass pipe and then smoke that. As I did that, now I had, I guess I've left an entire strain of thought off of here, and that is how I came across the Neprenol and the supplement. So like I said, I'd been using marijuana continuously for a year at that point, and even a little bit on and off before that I had tried in trying to get off of fentanyl. So... I was pretty happy with its ability. And a friend of mine, a coworker of mine, a couple weeks before I was to leave that job, just mentioned to me in a passing conversation that maybe I would want to try this stuff called Neprenol that supposedly dissolves scar tissue. So the day that I had boxed up all my books and everything was the second full day that I had taken the maximum dose that was recommended on the bottle. And then I inhaled my big unusual and combusted dose instead of dry herb vaped dose of cannabis. And as I did, I was also sitting on a ball chair and I was talking to my friend. And slowly, or not so slowly, pretty much suddenly, a sort of annular column surrounding my spine, and I would say starting at around T12, but that's kind of just a guess because it's, you know, a three-year-old memory. But that column kind of rose, it kind of emanated from T12 and both went upward and downward slowly. And I, as as this annular column of tissue like slowly began to tear and kind of liquefy, I could feel a fluid begin to drip inside my tissue. Strange. And stranger still is that fluid dripped through my tissues more and more. I could taste it stronger and stronger, kind of deep in my throat, near the area of my voice box, maybe slightly below. And this was, while it was the first time, this flavor signal became quite telling and important to me for the next about 18 months. And even to this day, now it's over 3 years later, and I still occasionally have a flavor whenever certain tissue tears. This is all the old tissue. How old, I don't know, but certainly things that have torn in the last few years, once they tear, they pretty much are done, with some notable exceptions that occurred in the beginning. So it's a lot to take in, I know. Tearing this CBG causing a tearing of tissue. I didn't really know that was what was going on. I was just getting more flexible. And as I'm explaining to my friend, you know, this annular column of tissue tearing that had now kind of finished, and I'm now more flexible, and I'm like, hey man, I'm a lot more flexible. I can taste this, you know, really pretty strong flavor. And I compared it to some earlier experiences that I'd had with them. And as I was doing that, a second column that sort of encompassed the first one, a little bit larger in diameter maybe, did the same thing, pretty much the same thing. I got more and more flexible. You know, there were a lot of steps. This went over the course of a bunch of hours. I called my mom at like 3 a.m. in Oklahoma, back in Oklahoma. And I called her crying and let her know that I had found a cure. And she cried. Now, I don't know if she actually believed me, and I haven't asked her, but I've never called her before or since and said anything like that before. So, and I haven't had any need because that has been the cure, pretty much. CBG. I didn't know it then, but I was finding marijuana strains that had small amounts of CBG in them, and I still don't know exactly what I need with the CBG per se. It's kind of still an open question. But let me tell you how I came to find it. So after I called my mom that morning, very early that morning, I tried to get a little bit of sleep, I think. I may have got 1 hour or whatever. But first thing I had to do, this was now Friday morning, was to go see my massage therapist, Deb. So Deb is in the same town where I live, so she's like a mile from me. But I had a 45-50 mile drive to work. One way every day, and I had to see her before I went in, though, on my last day. So she had just seen me 2 days before, and when she saw me this go-round, she could clearly see that I was much more flexible. You know, I did some, I forget exactly what it was, but there was a little test, sort of a little thing where we're making fun of my inflexibility that Wednesday, and then this Friday morning I did it. And we were both just kind of shocked. It was really cool. And so she felt my tissue. She could feel the difference then. I got into my car and tilted the seat like 4 or 5 clicks forward and drove to work. That was not the most productive day of work, but last days rarely are. And, you know, it was a day that's pretty well changed my life. It was also the first day that I completely discontinued using cannabis. It was quite easy because when you just take one dose at night, you know, okay, just don't do that. Pretty easy to do. And throughout the week, I just got worse and worse and worse. It was pretty demoralizing, actually. So I was still taking the Neprenol exactly as I was supposed to. I had read or heard or been told that it was very sensitive to digestion. You know, be sure you take it an hour before or 2 hours after a meal. I now use kefir quite a bit to help control my stomach acid with these enzymes, with the Neprenol. But anyway, I still got worse and worse on just the Neprenol. So I had had a gram. I had bought some industrial CBD. It wasn't from industrial hemp farms, I don't think, but I bought many grams of CBD over the years, and I would mix it into my vape juice, kind of as Jen mentions that she does in her vape juice in the last episode. But it never really did much for me. I interviewed at Apple on a hacked vaping cartridge that I converted to kind of burn CBD for me a little bit, CBD isolate. But it didn't really work very well. It was kind of just what I could do. I had this gram of, it was actually, it was CBD isolate that had strawberry cough terpenes added to it. And I bought that online, probably from a place out of Colorado. And I had tried it a little bit before, like, you know, like 50 milligram dose and just not gotten anything from it. So I didn't bother with it anymore. But I went and bought a dab rig that Friday, and I decided that, if THC-containing marijuana flower can maybe can cause this synergistic effect with this neprenol supplement, maybe if I take enough CBD, that'll work too. So I took about 2 hours and dabbed an entire gram of CBD isolate, and it was really rugged on my lungs. This is before the days of an e-nail. I was using a blowtorch and not particularly good at using a blowtorch. When I finished, I just had burnt lungs and a really bad feeling that this neprenol that I had just found and thought was going to be my savior was actually just another dead end. And I believe it was a Saturday morning, and I was pretty doggone dejected. I was lying on the floor, dejected, thinking, now I'm off fentanyl. I've had a taste of what could be, but it's gone away. What do I do now? And I remembered that I had a little bit of Rick Simpson oil. Now, I don't recommend you dab Rick Simpson oil, and most people will tell you not to dab it these days. Don't dab it. I would say don't. But I did this time, and this, like I said, this was several years ago. And I had one drop of it. And this was the experiment, you know. It was like, okay, so just the CBD, or what if I take this full spectrum extract that I believe had been made from strawberry lemonade, but it's really no way to tell anymore. Anyway, I didn't even exhale. And as I inhaled, all of the tissue began to dissolve and break up in the same way that it did when I had been on the neprenol for just 2 days and took the my last dose of the AK-47 as burned in a pipe. And so what I came to find out is that I could continue to get this synergistic effect, but I really had to pay attention to when and how I took the neprenol and when and how I consumed the cannabis. If I use my dryer vaporizer, it still pretty well worked for pain control, but I didn't get any of this breakup capability. And once you've had your flexibility improved, when you lose it again, you really want it back. I don't want to get too controversial here or anything, but basically what I'll say is that it's become my strong belief that, quote-unquote, our joints popping really isn't our joints, and it's not joint popping in most cases. What I believe is that these are fascial adhesions that are tearing or relocating and snapping the fascia like a guitar string. You know, for the first, definitely the first 9 months, almost everything that broke up would immediately readhere. And, you know, when you hear me, if you hear me talk about in other shows, talk about breaking up of something like the trapezius that took months, or when things began tearing. Most of the things in the first 9 months when they would tear, I would have to tear them again several times a day to several times an hour, for anywhere from maybe a few days to maybe a few months. It really depends on what the adhesion is like in that part. You know, what does the fascia go over, a bony prominence? Is everything kind of tight right there anyway? Over the course of my, I guess you would call it convalescence or metamorphosis or whatever has occurred to me in the last 3 years, not just to my own ears, but to the ears of bystanders and people that do and do not know what are going on. But definitely the popping, the sound that emanates from these tears is a little bit different than a normal pop most of the time. My legs, I've always been able to pop my toes like crazy. I have popped them quite a lot my whole life. But as everything, as my body has changed from these medications, I have almost completely lost the ability to be able to pop my toes. And the shape of my foot's totally different. Basically, everything just feels completely different. But I'm no longer able to quote unquote pop joints like I used to. And I believe that this is because that joint popping is the fascia tearing. From adhesion. So when I say fascia tearing, what I'm referring to generally would be fascial adhesions, or maybe this condition that I propose in here on the origin of the banding and fibromyalgia due to the distortion of the layers of the fascia. All right, maybe that will make sense later on. All right, so that dose of Rick Simpson oil was actually the only dose of concentrate that I had ever had at that time, and it was the only one that I owned and had access to, so it was the only dose of concentrate I had for many months. But I was able to, you know, use flour to move the process along, and after, I could go back and look at my notes, and I may do that if I redo this version of the show, but after a few months, I believe it was late February, one day I'd come back from the massage therapist and had been giving myself a very heavy massage, took a shower and medicated pretty heavily, I think. It was really burning. This is a pain I hadn't had in a while that had come back. And I have this plastic tool called a back body buddy. You can buy it on Amazon. And I was digging in one certain spot in my back so much that I actually ended up rubbing into the skin and drawing blood. And I kind of finished from that, and I stood up, and I was just watching TV, and I did a really light stretch and kind of rolled my shoulders forward. And as I did, a bright line, a bright white heat, like an incision, was made from the spot where I had been digging, directly, you know, transverse, perpendicular to my spine, but directly across the trapezius, basically to the other side of the trapezius, the other arm, other half of my back. And the whole, both sides of the trapezius, left and right, just kind of unfolded, and my neck lengthened and straightened, and it felt like that whole four vertebrae fusion just kind of finally found a new home that was in line with the rest of the spine where it hadn't been before. And that second changed my life, because the pain that it released me from just right there made it clear to me that I would be able to go on living. It was a very bad pain, and I'm glad it's gone. So once that began, once that happened, I knew I was really on to something, and that you know, this process could continue. And basically, that is, you know, we're now at the over 3 years of that continuation, and I've just gotten better. I feel better. I certainly can't do it without cannabis. I can't do it without THC. I don't seem to be able to do it without THCA, and maybe CBN. I have a lot of thoughts on what could be going on here. And I have a lot of experience, you know, with what's been going on. And I think... Hey, so specifically, if you're in Italy, and specifically, like, at the University of Padova, I'd love to speak to anybody from that group, and I would love to have someone from that group on this show, if they wouldn't mind. But You know, there's a lot of exotic mechanisms that could be going on here, and the way the cannabinoids work are so complicated. You know, they've got these two, you can kind of turn them on and off, and you can turn on and off the enzymes that metabolize the ligands, you know, the cannabinoids or whatever ones there. So I think you'll end up with some kind of like binary type state machine type math, as far as what the cannabinoids do, assuming that we don't add too many more receptors and things and enzymes that interact, because it's a lot of things to interact. But I think what is happening, so let me just say, I think in the accident that whenever I struck the first pole in particular and the second pole, that I was kind of crushed, and that the, if we just call each layer of fascia, let's say there are three everywhere, which I don't think is really true, but let's say that the envelope of my body consists of my, of what we call Steve, the reason why I have the shape that I do, aside from my bones. That's the fascia. And let's assume that there's three layers of that. I think that basically I was smeared into the ground. I kind of mentioned that in one of the shows. And I think this caused a distortion in my bones, a pretty distinct one, that caused a reorientation of everything. And then the fascial envelope now was locked into a different position inside of the other envelope, sort of like nesting dolls. And if you imagine that you're doing this with something like Tyvek or whatever, and you're trying to get these three conformal sheets to conform together, you can see where, so fibromyalgia is characterized by banding. And I think that banding is probably the origin of the deformation of the sheets of fascia, of the, you know, then it's sheet-like kind of nature. So it felt like to me, like all of my muscles were completely encapsulated in like 1 mil mylar Tyvek type material. Like I could never really build up my aerobic threshold, my lactate thresholds, you know, no matter what, riding a road bike several times a week. I mean, it was like I never could build up my wind. I think I was just completely bound with fibrin. And I think in this crushed state that the... in this distorted, wrinkled state, you know, maybe if you've got three layers, maybe the middle layer is the one that's kind of wrinkled in between. I think this state really impeded the flow of lymph. I think it really impeded the flow, and I think the accumulation of a lot of toxins was encouraged by both the malformation of the tissue, or the malconfiguration of the tissue, but also just by the medications. You know, I mean, think of all the chemicals I was ingesting with all of just the medications, and also just the American diet, which is also gone now. So I think, you know, part of the taste that varied spatially over time, when the tissue would break up, all these different flavors that I would get and how strong it was, I think a lot of that had to do with how much, like, cellular level contamination was being washed out of the tissue. And I think the job... So just quickly now, if you're the grad student there in Padova, I think the thing to look at is that the fibrin is basically just taking a ride on the hyaluronan that's being secreted by the fibroblasts in the fascia. And I think those enzymes are just being washed into the tissue and dissolving it. There's sort of a deposition of things that get otherwise loosened that make me kind of think this is the case. I imagine this story could sound pretty crazy if it's coming at you out of the blue. You know, it happened to me in about 16 and a half years to the day. Well, not to the day, but like 16 and a half years after the accident. It's a long time. And it's especially a long time if you sort of end up with something, but you don't know why. But yeah, so after about a year and a half of steady progress, I was intensely thirsty, especially in the first year and a half To the point where it wasn't even enough to just drink 3 liters of water a day. I really needed to have some coconut water in there too. Gatorade would kind of help. Powerade, not really at all. Coconut water was definitely the best, and I really needed a liter of that and 2 liters of water there for about 9 months for sure. And I kind of tapered down for the next 9 months, really the next like 18 months. And then I would say pretty much for the last year and a half, my thirst has been a lot more of a normal kind of level. But yeah, there for quite a while, I was really needing to drink a lot and run to the restroom a lot. Small price to pay. All right, well, I've sort of come to the conclusion that I'm not going to be able to communicate everything to everybody in any one show. And even if I could, you guys are probably not listening so intensely that you're picking up on every word I'm saying. So hopefully I'm just going to, you know, keep plugging away at this, and people understand that, you know, about 3 times a day, I use a combination of individual cannabinoids, primarily centered around CBG, second actors, definitely THC. And I think, you know, part of that probably has to do with this complex interaction. Well, we know it does, right? So the complex interaction of the cannabinoids, the endocannabinoids, the phytocannabinoids are the ones from the plant, the enzymes that break the cannabinoids down, and then the, you know, the various pathways for decomposition. I will tell you that going the edible route, it just, you know, I can't fine-tune my cannabinoids yet with confidence on edibles, but maybe I'll work on it, or maybe I'll just be better and not need anything. It doesn't seem, I don't know. It's very, very intoxicating for the benefit that I get, and so I really kind of stay away from the edibles. It's easier for me to just deal with the inhalation and get it over with. And I'm actually, at this point, I know I said in the previous show I get super duper high, but did you hear me super duper high? No. Because I'm pretty well saturated in THC so much I don't get a change from it anymore. Infrequently. Which is okay by me. That's the way other drugs work too, whenever you get onto painkillers. All right. I don't know. Maybe it sounds crazy. I'm sure it does sound crazy.